Good afternoon. Call to order. The City of Palm Coast Planning and Land Development Regulation Board Workshop. Today is Wednesday, October 8th, 2025. It is 5:30 p.m. Please stand with us for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Irene, roll call, please.
Chair Schenk.
Here.
Vice Chair Albano and Mr. Hilton are excused. Board Member Nicholson.
Here.
Board Member Ferguson is excused. Board Member Stancil.
Present.
Board Member Decker.
Here.
School Board Member Devana.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is public hearing, the presentation and discussion of proposed amendments to Chapter 5 of the Land Development Code. Mr. Winger, I pronounced it right.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, good evening, Madam Chair and HSA members. Today is the first workshop relating to the LDC update. Just to want to emphasize, this is not the Land Development Code rewrite. So basically, we're going to do some update due to to implement the adopted policy in May that City Council adopted, the comprehensive plan. So the amendments are based on that recent update related to implement the goal, objective, and policy. Also, we take this opportunity to clarify the intent of the regulation. There are, through the years, we experienced that there's certain language in the existing LDC not really have some interpretation, basically, so we're gonna provide that as well. And to update any references, so you'll see that. So tonight, we're gonna present to you the first chapter. We have selected Chapter 5 relating to transportation, connectivity, access, and parking. That's our first chapter to present to you. We have about approximately 10 revisions to the LDC. So the first one is relating to section 5.01.02, relating to applicability. So you can see the language here, we adding, including e-bike and micro-mobility. So it will read like this: all development shall provide transportation, access, parking, loading, stacking, bicycle, including e-bike and mobility, and pedestrian facilities in compliance with the standards of this chapter. So as you can see here, that it is underlined, those are the new, basically, language that we inserted in. If it's strike through, those are the language that either is ambiguous or is hard to understand. So that's what we you see that. So the next section is 5.02.01b4. So we strike through the entirety of that sentence there. So we replace that with the sentence so that you can see the intent clearer. Ensure that the use of local streets by design discourages pass-by traffic. I'll give you an example. Florida Park Drive, it is a local road, but it functions as a collector, and because it's connected to Palm Harbor and Palm Coast Parkway. And that's the type of local road that we want to discourage. So that's why we want this language to be in there. Make sure that local street by design discourages pass-by traffic. So that's what's in there. The next section is 5.02.01b6. Local streets shall be patterned in such a way that continuous traffic from a collector road to another collector or arterial road is discouraged. So again, reemphasizing the intent of local roads. So the proposed language that we want to insert in there, local streets shall be designed not to function as a collector road. So there's two sections there that emphasizes what a local road should be. Section 5.0204B, this is relating to a policy in Chapter 2 of the Comprehensive Plan chapter. It is relating to the number of dwelling units where it will trigger a certain requirement. So instead of, we used to have is the 50 dwelling units, so it reads like this: all new residential developments of more than 100 dwelling units, or which use as access a street that is 2,500 feet or more in length from another roadway, shall provide a minimum of two vehicular entrances from a public right-of-way. So we implement that throughout since we adopted the LDC in mid-2000, that any subdivisions that has 50 or more units, we require two points of access. The way we implement that is that we require one paved access and another one basically a stabilized emergency access. So that's why we've been implementing. So the change in our policy is that we're going to increase that to 100, and we still require two points of access. Okay? And in addition to that, we add this new sentence in there: for new residential developments exceeding 250 dwelling units, must provide two paved vehicular entrances. Now, we, based on existing development throughout Florida, and we also look at the Institute of Transportation Engineers, they recommend 200 units in order to basically require two paved vehicular entrances. But based on experience, based on what we looked at other subdivision, it could be increased to 250. It all depends upon the configuration of the internal roadways. Some of the internal roadways is very secretive. You know, how is layout, then it will be very difficult, so that we would require two. But basically, the number there, 250, was based on primarily from ITE recommendation, and so that's the new language that we gonna require new subdivision to provide that.
Do you want comments at each, or do you want to go through the whole thing and
you,
then
you can stop me at any time, please? Yeah.
So then let's stop right there.
Yes.
Are there any comments on the presentation thus far?
I do, just on this last one, because since the Florida recommendation is 200 dwelling units, why are we opting for 250? And I think it's a bonus that some of the developments have circuitous routes and so forth, but I think what's more important is the ease of the residents getting out to a main roadway without perhaps having to go through the entire development, and or if there is an incident that requires fire trucks or emergency vehicles, that there's more than one way to for entrance, as well as for the residents to exit without interfering with whatever that incident is.
Yeah, let me clarify my statement. ITE basically suggested, recommend 200 as the threshold to provide two entrances. It doesn't specify two paved entrances. You know, we've been implementing at 50. We require two, basically, vehicular entrances. One is a paved, one is basically emergency stabilized access. For us, we look at the development throughout, and we basically introduce 250 as the threshold to require two paved entrances. So that's, that's the justification behind that.
I was going to say, I think we've seen a number of developments come through here in the planning stage that really would have had the advantage of putting in those two paved roads had it been required to do so. The development would have been much improved if that was provided.
Yeah. So you made a comment also during the presentation where some of the developments are not designed in a way that two paved roads would function. Well, that should be part of their design when they first present it. So I don't think that we should be going into it with preconceived notion that it would be a disadvantage to them because of their design. Well, they shouldn't have a design that contradicts that when they're presenting it to us knowing that they should have two paved roads. And I think that exceeding what the recommendation would be for 200 to 250 would be a detriment to those residents. And I don't know why we're changing from 50 to 100 to have two paved roads when what we have now works. Why are we making it less restrictive on the developers when it's working already? If there was an issue that has been presented, if you know the issue of why we're changing from 50 to 100, and I think having two paved entrances for first responders would be a benefit, than to have one paved and one dirt, because those dirt roads end up getting potholes and other aspects that can ruin the vehicles or limit their emergency response. So I think that we should, I would recommend keeping the 50 and going to the 200 versus the 250. Those are recommendations.
I hear you. What we're doing is that basically the LDC is implementing the policies that we adopted. So we already, council already adopted at our 100. So this is not a change that we are introducing. This is a change to reflect the policies in the comprehensive plan.
So pretty much what we're being presented with today, we really don't have a say in.
For the 50 to 100, no. That's basically reflecting the policies.
But we do have with the others?
Yes, well, for the 250, currently we basically, if you talk about fire services, they are okay with one paved access and one stabilized emergency access. And they are okay with that. We are introducing requirement to have two paved access if you're exceeding 250.
Okay, and then, so as we're going through, if it's something that's a red line with the change, my understanding would be that we don't have a say in it, but the others where you're adding something, we could give input to.
Yes.
And then if we say, hey, well, I think that we should go to 200 versus 250, can we do that?
From which one?
From your recommendation of exceeding 250 units, we could say we would like that to be, do we make a motion to do that at 200, or what is our position here?
Yeah, your position is to provide your comments, and then
okay.
We basically, staff will take your comments, we'll reevaluate, and based on the majority of the comments, we'll basically reintroduce the change. So
okay.
Let's say the agency majority of you would agree to reduce it down to 200, or increase it to 300, then we'll take that into consideration and we'll introduce that.
So I would think that my recommendation from us to the staff would be to change that from 250 to 200 and provide more paved entrances for the residents and first responders.
We'll take note of that, yes.
And I would support that as well.
So one of the questions I would have is, do we know the status update on Senate Bill, was it
180?
180. Do we know the update to that? Because if reducing it to 200 places an unnecessary financial burden, say for example, I lived in South Florida when Hurricane Andrew came through and Country Walk was destroyed. So if that developer wanted to redevelop that area according to Senate Bill 180 standards now, and we had that at, say, for example, 200 requiring two paved roads, with Senate Bill 180 as it was proposed, could that prevent that requirement if it deems as an unnecessary financial burden to the developer?
Let me try to address that to you and the agency. Basically, right now, we this is going to be just workshops. So we're basically providing the changes to reflect the policies that council adopted. And then we're going to take your input into that. And we anticipating that the legislature may make some modification to 180. And by that time, we'll revisit to see which basically processes that we you know, introduce that will be more burdensome. Mm-hmm. Then we basically will remove that. But at this time, we're basically going to provide the reflecting the policies.
And the reason why I brought that up is that as we move through it, if it's something that Senate Bill 180, as proposed, would trump, then you know, we need to make sure we keep that in mind. If we make it too restrictive, and then Senate Bill Trump 180 would trump it anyway, then we wouldn't have anything to say about it, nor would City Council have anything to say about it. So just keeping that in mind.
Yes, we do. You know, for example, let's say there's no changes to 180, and then this requirement will be more restrictive or more burdensome. It's not defined what that means, but we will not introduce that, but we will introduce the 100 because that is basically relax the restriction. So that's not burdensome. So right. For example.
So I think we just, as we go through this, we can keep that in our mind, but we don't want to make a decision based on a bill that may not pass, and if we do put something in that does restrict the builders a little bit, like you mentioned, the city and stuff isn't making a decision yet, and we can always, they can always make changes to this after the fact if that bill does go into effect. But I think if we think that there's something and we have a good reason behind it, we would do the recommendation, and if it gets overturned with the Senate bill, then we face it at that time.
Yeah, I think that's the strategy that we moving forward to. So we'll basically go through the next 8 months or so, get your collective input, including the public as well, and then we'll consolidate that into a document, and then we'll see what would happen to 180. And then at that time, we'll bring it back to you and then let you know that these are the changes for what we're going to move forward.
Right, and just for the members of the public to know that there are things that do happen with the legislature that sometimes tie our hands.
Yes.
That it's not because we, you know, we're voting in a particular direction because that may not be the necessary thing that we want to do necessarily, but that may be what we have to do sitting quasi-judicial following what the statute says.
And I think what if we make it more restrictive and there ends up with a particular site, with a particular developer, and there is a hardship, they certainly can come and ask for relief. I mean, they do that.
Yeah.
Right.
So that would be a way to, you know, accommodate, but be more proactive towards the residents as opposed to necessarily a burden to them. Thank you.
That's true.
Thank you.
May I move forward?
Please continue, yes.
So in section 5.02, for F, basically we are looking at the to the fullest extent practical all rural arterial and collector section within 1 mile of an urbanized area shall be considered for the construction of a paved shoulder 5 feet in width. The reason is that in our language, in our LDC currently it's 4 feet, but state standard right now, all the paved shoulders are 5 feet. So we're basically reflecting that change, that's all. Okay.
That's like what we're seeing on Whiteview Parkway, right?
Yes, well, Whiteview Parkway, we got to put in a bigger multi-purpose path. I think it's going to be 12 feet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, instead of 5 feet. Yeah, so. Section 5.03.04b3, relating to the trust fund, so basically if the construction of a sidewalk is not currently feasible or practical, the land use administrator may allow the developer to make a payment to the Palm Coast Sidewalk Improvement Trust Fund in lieu of sidewalk construction. So that is currently the language in there. design and location of new sidewalk must be part of a subdivision or site plan. If sidewalk location is within private property, then a legal instrument must be provided to have public access. The legal instrument can be provided in a plat as a right-of-way or and or access easement. So to explain this, the design and location of the new sidewalk must be part of the subdivision or site plan. So there are certain areas, for example, on, Evolve, I think, is the one on US 1. And it's fronting basically US 1 there. And state probably, let's say, if our regulations require that to have basically provide sidewalk on state road, and if the state's okay with that, and then the developer have an option, either they're going to construct that portion of US 1 for sidewalk, they may do so, or they can basically provide us the fund for that based on the length of their frontage. So that's one aspect of it. So the reason we put it in here is to make it clear that any subdivision, any site plan, including basically commercial site plan, that as you can see, that's clearly that we're going to require that sidewalk, either a construction or a funding mechanism that they have to pay into the sidewalk.
So you're saying that they will either have to pay, or they would have to construct it, or they would have to pay the city to construct it, for the city to construct it. But
right.
It has to be on their site plan, and if it's private property owned by that builder, so they have to give the city legal authority to be able to build on it.
Yes, yeah. If it's on private property, they have to provide us either a right-of-way on the plat, or they provide us basically an access easement for public access.
Okay.
Yes.
But in the example you just mentioned, why wouldn't it be practical or feasible for that developer to build that sidewalk? Like, I'm trying to understand, like that's one example, but this seems much more ambiguous than that.
Your question is that why don't they construct?
Well, on the example you just provided,
yeah.
Why would it not be feasible for that developer to build that sidewalk on Route 1?
That's their option, that whether they want to construct that or not. I think we want to make it clear that that's one of their obligation is to provide that sidewalk. Whether you're going to provide the funding for the city to later on to come through there in order to do the sidewalk, or they can construct the sidewalk.
I don't think this says that, because
that
currently not feasible or practical doesn't mean you have the option to do it or not.
Mm-hmm.
The language just sounds different than what you're saying.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I'll try to help as to why you have this option, right? And it has to do with, you've heard the term sidewalks to nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And typically it's somebody has property, and if we allow them to build a sidewalk at the time of their development, but yet you have vacant lands to the left and to the right, for lack of a better term, let's say to the east and the west, it is had been city's preference that you provide the funds that we need so that we will construct the sidewalk at a time where that sidewalk will actually connect to something that will lead you to somewhere.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
Yes,
but
ma'am.
I don't think that's what this says. I don't interpret this that way.
So the way I look at it is it's practical. So practical would fall into where he mentions that if it's a sidewalk to go to nowhere, if you got a 40-foot frontage and you build 20 feet of sidewalk, because 20 feet is entrance to the development or so, and you got 10 feet of sidewalk on each side, and then it goes into a dirt lot. So that's where I see the practical being, and that's how I interpret this. And it says use administrator may allow the developer to make. So it's up to the administrator to make that decision, not the developer.
But what if we're not talking about a development that's on Route 1? We're talking about a development that has 250 homes throughout it, and are they required to build a sidewalk in that community? So in that case, why would the city be allowing them not to do it and the city taking on the responsibility to build that sidewalk in that development that's got curved roadways? I mean, I, Route 1, that piece, what you're describing makes complete sense, but I'm thinking about other scenarios where you've got developers where there isn't necessarily a connector to a public sidewalk.
Yeah, I just wanna let you know that basically this is not for internal sidewalk within the subdivision. This is basically for fronting our public roads. Then they are required to provide sidewalk on a public road. So
could we add that in here to clarify that? That would make it a lot more clear for the person who's interpreting this.
Yeah, so for example, there's a subdivision that is about to come in, and we basically request them to provide us 12 feet of additional right-of-way. And that may basically hinder their development. So part of that is that we allow them within the setback to provide the sidewalk in their, on their private property in order to have a continuous public sidewalk. In that case, that we would need the basically an access easement on their property. So that's a one example for that. If it's clearer to put the word public in there, public right of way, then yeah, we'll introduce that.
Or public sidewalk.
Right.
I think that makes it clear what you're trying to achieve.
And this historically, the term practical, we've always within the office. Is it practical to build a sidewalk that doesn't connect to anything? And that's the way that we've interpreted and used that term, practical.
Right, and I'm totally in agreement with that if we understand, first of all, what sidewalk we're talking about.
So for example, that same project evolved. 3 years ago, it came in, and DOT said, no, we don't want sidewalk on US 1, okay? So in that case, our regulations require them to have to pay to the sidewalk fund. That we can use that funding in order to basically provide local match for DOT to provide the sidewalk. Because DOT typically comes in and they want to provide a continuous sidewalk for at least a mile or 2 miles to do that. They recently changed the policy. They say, if they can construct and provide sidewalk along a state road, that's fine too. So that's the reason why we now they get back in. You know, the project has been in the work for many years now. Now they get back in, the DOT policy changed that. So that's the work. One of the reasons we apply that is like practical is that, hey, DOT doesn't allow us to do that. Then you still have. Required to pay into the sidewalk fund for the city, you know, for example, and so. But anything that you see, provide your input as to make it clearer, then we would welcome that. So,
thank you.
I got a question. Over on Seminole Woods, you got Seminole Palms new subdivision. There's a from the entrance. There's a sidewalk that was built down to the end of their property, and about 30 feet. Into the woods. I was told that Palm Coast built that sidewalk to nowhere. I don't understand. So I'm reading this and wondering, why didn't the builder build his own sidewalk in front of his own property? But then I always say, okay, so they can say, oh, it's too much of a burden. Here, we'll let you do it. But why is it 30 feet to past the property?
I'm curious about that. Seminole Palms on Citation Boulevard?
On Seminole Woods Boulevard.
Oh, Seminole Woods Boulevard.
Seminole Woods Boulevard. Seminole Palms is that new housing area, yeah. Just past where the new fire department is. And there's a sidewalk goes past where they put palm trees, and then 30 feet beyond that, or maybe 50. They built a sidewalk going to nowhere.
Is this the sidewalk on Seminole Woods?
It's on Seminole Woods Boulevard.
Okay, so
yeah.
Seminole Woods Boulevard has a pretty wide right-of-way. And typically, the location that we place the sidewalk is basically about 2 or 3 feet off of the edge of the right-of-way. So that's why you see that it's a little bit, you know, farther away from the edge of pavement of Seminole Woods. That's the only reason why we did that.
No, I think what he's talking about is the width of the property. The frontage of the development, say, is 100 feet wide, and then so the sidewalk spans that 100 feet plus an additional 30 feet past the edge of that property or where the current building is. Why would they add an additional 30 feet of sidewalk to nowhere? Or why would they even add that 100 feet of sidewalk then if it goes to nowhere on both sides? Because there's no development on both sides.
Yeah, I have to take a look, but I'm not sure.
I think that you would have to look at the specific site in order to be able to answer that question.
Sure.
Okay. Continue, please.
Thank you. So the next one is 5.0302.C. So all new residential and non-residential development adjacent to a proposed multi-use path consistent with the bicycle pedestrian master plan shall provide a 12-foot wide trail pathway. The reason we changed it from 8-foot to 10-foot, now 12-foot, is because of the funding that the state is requiring us to do. Where it's feasible, we need to provide a 12-foot in order to get funding for a multi-purpose path. The biggest funding that state provides is the SunTrip, basically. So that one, they require DOT, the state requires a 12-foot pathway. So that's why we changed that to a 12. Rarely do we have, you know, we used to have like 8-foot, and that was okay, but then we expanded to 10-foot, and they now basically, the state standardized that to 12-foot. So that's the reason why we're updating that.
Is the state going to pay for that extra width?
I'm sorry?
Is the state going to pay for that extra width?
Yeah.
Because we certainly don't need 12.
If we receive the funding, yeah, they will provide that. Right?
Okay, so but if we build 12, they're going to have to pay for that extra 4 feet.
So what he's saying is the state will only fund us if we do a 12-foot wide trail.
Well, the state's going to pay for it. Yeah.
If we do 8 to 10, they will no longer fund us like they used to.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Gotcha. So yeah, then no brainer.
So next one is 5.0304.B.3. So this is relating to an interesting area of development. So residential driveways entering the public right-of-way shall be a minimum of 10 feet wide at the right-of-way line and 16 feet wide at the roadway edge. So this is existing language. On corner lots, driveways shall not enter the right-of-way within 25 feet of where the two right-of-way lines intersect. So if you read the old language, it's like within 25 feet of where the two right-of-way lines would intersect if extended. So we're not sure what that means, but we understand clearly is that basically where they intersect. I think we just clarify that language. So. The next one is 5.0304.B.5. This is basically the introducing through experience through the years, staff experience through the years. We allow turnarounds in basically in the residential house. So you typically have a driveway, but then some people would like to have a turnaround area. And we basically said, okay, in order to do that, you need this. this much worth and this much debt. And they asked us, where is that in the code? So we didn't have no place in the code to refer to. So that's why we basically introduced to them that in this language that the turnaround shall be a maximum of 9 feet wide by 18 feet long. So we also just received recent comment is that what about circular driveway? So we think it's a good basically revision that probably residential units that has basically circular driveway, then we would not allow basically turnaround, for example. It's because that serves as a turnaround. So we may introduce that in the future. Yeah. And then in section 5.0402A, this is the parking table relating to mini warehouse or self-storage facilities, including boat and recreational vehicle storage. Okay. So the current language continues after the word storage. Two spaces per 100 storage units and a minimum of 4 vehicle boat storage spaces. Okay. So it's difficult for us to implement because so if you have a self-storage mini warehouse coming in, the requirement, the minimum is basically 4 vehicle boat storage. And if you have additional 100 storage units, then you have to provide 2 spaces. I don't think the intent is there to clearly, because when we want to implement this, it's going to be a little bit difficult, and it basically places on staff to interpret what this means. So you get every 100 storage unit, you provide 2 vehicle spaces, and a minimum of 4 vehicle boat storage spaces. So does that mean that we have to provide 4 additional boat storage spaces, or what are we talking about here? So we are introducing to clarify this language is that minimum of 4 spaces required. So any mini warehouse or self-storage facility would have to provide 4 spaces. Facilities providing more than 200 storage units require an additional 1 space per 50 units. Storage units include both indoor storage units and outdoor RV boat storage spaces. So we count them all.
So what you're taking away is the identifying factor of the space that has to be for a boat storage. So now you're really just not identifying what type of vehicle, but so they could have 4 spaces for a car and nothing for a boat, so they can make smaller spaces. I mean,
yeah, because if they're gonna provide boat and recreational vehicle storage, they would already include it in their facility in the back for that already, for storage.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it's just, I mean, okay, yeah. It's the same amount of spaces, you're just taking out the word boat.
Yeah, because the original language is a minimum of 4 vehicle boat storage spaces. Does that mean we provide 4 vehicle spaces and 4 boat storage spaces? We're not sure.
That's okay,
yeah.
You're just taking out the how someone's gonna interpret it.
Correct, right. Yeah. We just wanna make it as you know, as clear as it can be, so.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that concludes our proposed revisions to chapter 5. So as I said, again, this is basically, we do the update to reflect the policies and basically provide any clarification to existing code. So the next step is that additional question and on proposed amendment, we'll happy to take that. Other potential amendments from the board as well. And schedule for moving forward. reports, staff will present other LDC chapters in the coming months to the board. And then we have a workshop on follow-up, basically amendment. So I'm going to present to you our a schedule from here to the end of the year. And then we'll introduce the following year a schedule approximately in December for you. So you can see here, this is the first one, October 8th, chapter 5. And then October 15, if necessary, if you want to continue with this and have one discussion or dialogue, then we'll resume that. If not, we'll basically not going to have chapter 5. But then on October 15 is your regular, basically, business meeting. You have basically right now two agenda items on that. And we follow with a workshop on chapter 7, which is related to concurrency management system. So October 15, we'll do that. And if you need additional time in order to discuss that, then we would have it on October 22nd. If not, then we'll not going to meet on October 22nd. So this, you see the following dates there. Some of them we place it as basically just a placeholder, just in case that you need additional time. And with that, I conclude my presentation. If you have any questions, I'm available.
Return to the board. Are there any questions?
No, I think we voiced our concern on the 250, recommending 200, and the board kind of agreed on that. And then I think, do you mind pulling the schedule back up?
I think Ms. Nicholson also wanted the word public included in the description.
If there was a way to add that to the sidewalk to kind of make it more clear for the general public to understand, even though we understand it. I don't think we would need to review this again on the 15th, and we can move on to the next one, but I don't know about the rest of the board.
Well, we will wait, staff will go back with the comments that have been made now to consider if there are any revisions. And when we have a regular meeting next week, present to us if you think we need to review it again. But I think right now, we've kind of come to a consensus on what our recommendations are, or our comments.
Your comments.
Our comments are.
So basically, we'll take your comments, and then when we present it to council, we'll also present your comments relating to the changes that you just provided to us. And then we'll take additional comments from the city council, and we'll basically put that in a document, and we'll see what happens next year, and then we'll come back to you and the board to say, okay, based on collective comments, this is the proposed changes. Yeah.
So then based upon that, then we should be prepared for the presentation on concurrency management system next week.
Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. We do have members of the public here.
Certainly.
We would like to open for public comment. Please approach and state your name and address for the record.
Sidewalks are essential. I live in an area without sidewalks. We have swells that don't work, that get flooded in some areas. But they are essential because you have people who walk their dogs, you have kids who go for the school bus. The two exits, now let's stay on the sidewalks. The sidewalks, if you can't have a sidewalk on each side of the street, we should have only at least on one side. Because it's better to have one side of sidewalks than none at all, nothing at all. Now, I don't understand why somebody who would have a private property would oppose to have a sidewalk put on his land instead of swells. That's above my understanding. But if they don't, I mean, this is still his property. The but they could also plan for the sidewalks out of this property and also altogether. Now, he talked about two entrances, and I think it's essential, no matter how many houses are in the new development, there should be two entrances, because it's a way to get emergency vehicle faster if necessary. If you have on the street traffic and you can't access that road that is farther, and you have one entry here, it's better than nothing. Okay, so also, so I don't want for people to exit. Yeah, people need to exit the street too if there's traffic. So two entrances, that would be better. That's pretty much it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any additional?
Sidewalks, streets, different requirements. Can we have an exemption or a workaround if somebody's trying to put in affordable housing? That is being missed right now. An issue that has come up in some of the developments is buses having difficulty because the streets are not wide enough or there's no turnaround for a bus. So kids are walking over a mile to get to their bus. So that's another thing when you're doing new developments, maybe just have them put a turnaround so the bus can turn around where the mailboxes are. We got to think about safety. We have to think about our kids and parking. Our parking restrictions can inhibit affordable housing because of the additional costs. I don't understand why a duplex is a different size than a townhouse when it comes to parking restrictions. If we could build a 1,500 square foot duplex and only require one parking spot, well now we may be able to have something that is affordable for our people. And when I talk about affordable housing, they're gonna look exactly the same as every other house in the neighborhood. Nobody's gonna know the difference except for the person living in that home or the developer that helped them to get there. We need to come to understand that it is our workers that have trouble finding a home and can't afford a home. What happens when there's no servers left because they can't afford to live here? It all starts right here with the planning board, and these are things we need to start considering now, so that we don't have to go back and try to keep changing everything when that builder comes and wants to do that affordable housing complex. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any additional members of the public? Please approach.
State your address also for the record.
1370 Palm Harbor Parkway. I think it's a good idea to look at everything. As Valerie had mentioned, in the code it says that if a duplex is 1,300 square feet or less, it's only a one-car garage. But a townhouse is 1,500 square feet or less. And that doesn't make any sense to me why the difference. I also don't understand why we're putting limits on people's driveways, as long as it's not in the right of way or the setback. That's in here too. There are a lot of people that don't like grass right now, so why can't they just pave what they want, as long as they have the landscaping, which is also part of this? I think think now would be a good time to look at all of this since we are doing the comprehensive plan as well. And again, when you're talking about developments, I feel that there needs to be a piece that says if it is an affordable housing project that has this definition, it can be on a case-by-case basis that things can be changed in order to make it more affordable to live. And that is a piece that is missing right now. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Are there any additional members of the public that would like to speak? Seeing none, we'll close public comment. We return to actually staff, if staff wants to be able to address any other comments.
Yes, I would like to provide some information on the comments. The first one is, why don't we have a sidewalk throughout our community, our city? We were basically designed by ITET with swells, and within the edge of roadway to the property line, we have about 15 feet of basically public right-of-way. In order to provide sidewalks, we basically have to put piping underneath there in order to channel the stormwater. We roughly estimated probably about my number, I don't know what it is, but I think it will exceed $1 billion in order for us to do all the local roads with sidewalk, even with one side. So that's a financial issue that we would not. But all new subdivisions we require to have sidewalk on local roads. And on top of that, all the new improved roads will have sidewalks on both sides, or at least one side a 5-foot sidewalk, and on the other side would have a multi-purpose path. And because we, years ago, we did a pilot program on Pine Lakes for the multi-purpose path. And we saw a lot of people, the community, came out and use that facilities from, I think our first test run was from Palm Coast Parkway, go south and head east to Belterre. And that was very popular, so that's the reason why we continue to do multi-purpose paths. A lot of people like that, so we're going to use that. But in order to retrofit what is already constructed, modifying that is extremely costly in order to do that. So that's one issue. I agree with the last resident there talk about the requirement for parking. Why a townhouse is less restrictive, for example. So we're going to look into that. So there are areas that as we go through that, staff is looking into that and see to basically make it basically fairer for all types of development. It doesn't prohibit us from making changes to the existing code, but it just basically, we just want to make sure the message out there is that we're not rewriting the entirety of the LDC. That's not our task at this time. Our task this time is that we basically gonna reflect and implement the policies. But along the way, there are certain things like that we can see that we will introduce changes as well.
I think also about the parking requirements for affordable housing. Ms. Kleiner mentioned that. Will that be addressed in the housing section of the LDC?
Okay. So as a separate task, as called for by the comprehensive plan, we are doing an affordable housing study. And so I believe that when that study comes to a conclusion, we will have a number of strategies that would address some of the comments that are being brought up at this workshop. And of course, that's not the only ones. There are other, these are mainly focused on the land development code and how things are built. But there are other strategies that we have to look at also to address affordable housing beyond what's just in the code right now. So I think although we are introducing it chapter by chapter, I think there will come a point where that particular issue or topic of affordable housing will come as a package, likely to AHAC and then eventually to the board and city council, where you can see as a whole package what are some of the strategies. Some of them will, as we see here, will probably include amendments to the land development code, and some will probably be new additions to the land development code. And again, those will be introduced as part of that study, and as any amendment to the code, it will go through our planning agency, followed by city council.
Thank you. Do we have any other comments from the board?
I'd like to say, affordable housing is really critical for Palm Coast's future. If we're going to get young people to come and live here, they've got to be able to afford to live here. But, you know, we've got to be able to have a place to live. We've got to get jobs for them, too. We've got to get some industry in here, light industry, maybe some medical industry, get some jobs for them. You know, until we get jobs, we're not going to get young people to come here. But we're going to have a place for them to live. You know, I know I ran for city council last year, and that's one of my platforms. And it went over well. But that's what the city needs. So, you know, affordable housing, you got a young couple, they're going to have two cars. They need more than one car parking space. You know, you got to look at that. So that's all I got to say.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
So a few comments that came from the public. The two entrances, I know that's something I commented on too. Going into a development as a former law enforcement officer, if the road, there's an accident at the intersection at that entrance, you're blocked. And if the public has no clue where the emergency entrance is, where that entrance is used only for emergency personnel, the public can't have it. And sometimes it takes hours to clear a roadway. So, especially in the entrance. So that's where I think that I harp on the two entrances being paved into really any development. So I think that that's a concern. I know we have brought this up multiple times about turn lanes into these developments. And there's no requirement that we've been presented with or anything that on a main road such as Seminole Woods, where there's a turn lane installed to turn into these communities and these developments, where it becomes a safety hazard, you're going to get rear-ended. So I know we brought that up, and I think that's something that needs to be addressed, because when you're trying to turn left and the rear end of your vehicle is sticking out into that lane, and someone's not paying attention, they're going to hit you, and it's going to cause an accident. So that's one of the things I think that needs to be brought up with turn lanes. I brought the accidents, bus stops. I've got four kids in the school system, and there's no bus stops, and the buses are stopping in the middle of the road on Seminole Woods, and it's a safety issue for the school buses. It's a safety issue for the kids. I think there should be covered areas, too, where these bus stops are. These kids are standing out in the rain, so I think that's something the school board needs to look at, something that our city needs to look at, too, that this is not the sleepy town anymore, and we're getting a lot more families, children in town, and we need to make it more accessible for them and safer. So I think that's something that we need to look at is bus stops. I speak on Seminole Woods. I live down there. There's plenty of road space or sidewalks, or not sidewalks, the edge of the road that they could easily say, hey, we're going to pave this towards bus only, and the bus can pull in there, get off the main road, where the bus stop is, pick the kids up, and then turn back in the lane of traffic, all the vehicles at the stop so they can go in and out. So I think that's something that you guys should be looking at with this land development. Those swales, she spoke on sidewalks in the communities. I love that idea. I know that it's cost effective. The city spends a lot of money on maintaining those swales, and it's they need to do a better job at it because it floods everything. And sidewalks with piping would not be a bad idea. One way to fund it would be, everybody's harping on
companies having their marked vehicles and in their driveways. If we implemented a fee for those companies that paid $500 for a pass for a year, and a little sticker in their window, that $500 a year per vehicle could cover that cost of adding sidewalks and piping through the city. So if we look at other ways of funding it through some of these individuals, I'll pay $500 to have my car wrapped, and that can pay for it. We've talked about affordable housing a number of times on this committee, and it is definitely a huge issue. So anything that you guys are doing to help would be worth it. And then we've talked about it a few times. People come and ask us why we allow some of these rules to happen. We just have to follow what the city says. Our committee doesn't make a lot of it, doesn't make the rules. We just say, does it meet the city's requirements, yes or no? Does it provide a benefit or a detriment to the city? And then we give our recommendations. So sometimes we wish we had more pull, and we just don't. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Just follow up on what you said about the charging a fee with a sticker. I personally brought that up to the city council twice.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I heard you.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, we follow the land development code. And that's why I want to commend the public that's here tonight to be involved in this process. And those who may be listening, there's been a timeline outlined here tonight of the presentations. And we encourage more members of the public to participate, so that one, we can better understand what the land development code is, and we can hear your comments, your feedback. The other thing is, I think it's an excellent idea about the merge lane for the school buses. And maybe that is something that we look at for the future developments, that they have that type of a lane. I don't know the exact term for it either, but I remember there was a city, and I can't even remember the city I was in, but they had that where the buses didn't stop the traffic, the flow of traffic. So the buses just pulled into that lane, picked up the people, and they continued on. However, for school buses, you know, any traffic would still have to stop. But I think it would definitely be for future development, any developments coming in, if we could look at that in this land development code, I think that's a really, really great idea.
I think every new construction development, too, should have a bus stop built in. So Seminole Palms on Seminole Woods, they've got the front community center right there with all the mailboxes and stuff. They could be told, hey, we're going to make a school bus stop here to make it safer, where the school bus can pull off of Seminole Woods, turn around, pick up the kids right there, and then pull back out into Seminole Woods. So I think that's something that we can always look at, too.
Through the chair, man?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to provide some of the input into that. Affordable housing, we're looking at approximately in February, we'll have a study, roughly, right?
Yeah, the strategy should come sometime in February, but we will have data analysis likely before the end of the year.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And then we also, as we go through the land development code, we're also going to look at probably expand additional zoning in order to provide affordable housing community. In the past, we have tried this, but I don't think it worked out. Basically, certain subdivision, we require them to provide, let's say, 10% as affordable housing units. At the end of the day, they say, okay, we're going to pay to you to, you know, relieve that, because they couldn't make it work. So that's a huge issue with the development community of builders. That's one thing that my experience, I saw that. In relating to our turn lane, we have very strict turn lane requirements for new subdivisions. On existing subdivision, for example, on Seminole Woods, there are basically no turn lanes there. I already have proposed a study to the TPO for funding. We're going to have that funded to study approximately 24 intersections citywide. And then I proposed in the budget, previous, you know, the, I mean, this fiscal year, about 7.2 million. But I think I only got 1 million. So so what we're going to do is that we're going to study those intersections and then as a recommendation from that, we'll prioritize that and we'll use the money in order to improve each intersection at a time. So yes, we recognize that as well.
So how much money is being focused on these studies? Because I think a lot of the time the studies, depending on the cost, waste our taxpayers' money when we already know it's an issue. You guys know it's an issue. And it seems like you're just collecting the data to check the boxes when, and I'm not saying you specifically, but the system uses it to check the boxes when we know it's something that needs to be done. We can find the funding one way or another. He's recommended it multiple times in the city council, and we just brought it up today. Do a little parking pass for every business vehicle that wants to park in their driveway that has a logo on it. $500 a person, and you have 1,000 vehicles, there's $500,000 right there that can go to adding a number of turn lanes each year. So how much money are we going to spend on the studies?
The study will be provided to us through the TPO funding, so no dollars will come out of the city's budget. And the reason we have studies is to do away with the word arbitrary. We don't want to, who's gonna provide a justification whether we're gonna do intersection ABC or XYZ. So that's the reason why we have a study. The study to determine that this is more critical for you to improve rather than the other one. So that's one of the, and the third reason is that we can also pursue additional state dollars. Without a study, they're not going to even look at it. So that's the reason why.
I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
For 2 years now, I've been talking about the problem in Sesame and Seminole Woods needing a right turn lane because the traffic gets backed up. Everybody's going down to one, comes through the second Sesame. Now, the northern Sesame has a left and right turn lane, but nobody goes there. And every time they say, oh, we're working on it. Oh, we've got studies. Well, how many studies does it take to figure out you just need to put the damn right turn lane in there?
You told me
yourself we're working on it.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any existing studies on those intersections at all. Well, so that's the reason why we are pursuing this funding for this study.
And I think it's important to note also because it's public dollars. And because you're using public dollars, you have to check the boxes to ensure financial responsibility and accountability. And we all know that government is a cumbersome process. That's for sure. Anything that you see, I try to tell people, when you see something coming up out the ground with the government funding, it's probably been at least 5 years that you've been trying to get, you know, from the time it's awarded to the time that you see the shovel in the ground. So that's the reality of it. We're talking about public funding and public works that we are identifying, things that need to be done. But we do appreciate all the public comments has been closed, though.
Do you have a list of the studies that you guys have done on the roads? Is there a place that the public can see all the studies that have been done so that they know?
Yeah, Stormwater and Engineering Department has that. I can basically ask them to put it in on a website, for example.
Okay, so there's not currently anywhere that the taxpayers of Palm Coast can go and look at all the studies that have been done and maybe the costs to them to be more transparent to everybody, but also so that way we can see, has there been a study for this intersection or not? So then we're not questioning you guys. You guys don't have to have public records requests to obtain those documents. They can just be a link on a website and they can pull it up just like we're doing here.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. We have corridor studies, segment studies, a few intersection studies, but we don't post that on our website. So I think that's a good suggestion.
Yeah, we could do that. That would clear up a lot of miscommunications or people saying that they're not privy to the information and we're hiding something.
Sure. Sorry, guys.
Absolutely. And like those, like when we went down to the planning conference, planners training, you know, there are certain municipalities that have interactive live websites that are showing real time what's going on within that community. So maybe if we had something like that, from anything from transportation to public works to housing, you know, commercial development, everything is live and people can go there and see what's actually going on within the city. Because right now, you know, we're trying to overcome a lot of distrust. And I think that's going to be the only way that we're going to be able to combat that is by having full transparency. And when you mentioned, when we get to the housing chapter, the possibility of looking at different types of zoning, are you referring to what is we've known as inclusionary zoning, something that with the Affordable Housing Advisory Committee we brought up a long time ago? If we had inclusionary zoning designation, then a developer would in essence just offer to pay the city to avoid having to build affordable housing. You're building in that zone, it has to be there at the zoning district.
Yeah, we'll look into that.
Thank you.
When you brought it up, the fee that the developer pays to not have to build affordable housing, is there a set fee or is it based on how many developments or units that they were supposed to build affordable housing? And is that like a set fee so the developer knows, hey, I'm gonna say I'm gonna build affordable housing knowing I'm not going to, but I'm going to build it and know that, hey, I just have a $10,000 fee at the end of my build that I can pay the city? Or is it saying, is there increments or phases that say, if you don't build affordable housing in your first phase or second phase of six, that you pay this much, and then if you don't build affordable housing by phase three, you pay this much, or and do a step program to either say, hey, you've got to build affordable housing up front or in the middle, and if you don't, you pay this fee. And then if you play the game and wait it all out through your phase six and say, you know what, we just didn't do it, now you have to pay twice as much.
The only danger in that is that then they could, take for example on US 1 where you have the large developments going in and they're phasing them. If they've chosen to not have an inclusionary model, everybody on the front end could have been paying market rate and they push all of the affordable housing to the back. That's the only risk with that phasing process. They're not forced to for that inclusionary model. So that if I pull into that community, you can't tell if I'm living in an affordable home, a house that has been designated affordable housing because it looks just like yours. That's the only thing. But I think if they put a percentage of housing up front has to be affordable housing. So for example, if you're coming in and you want to develop, you start at 40 units, 40 homes, well, 15% of those 40 homes must be affordable housing up front. And that way, like you're saying, if they think, oh, it's a $10,000 fine, if I'm building 500 homes, I'll pay the $10,000. But if it is a percentage, I don't even think we should give that out. It should be required. This is what you're, if you're asking to build in this zoning district, this is what you have to do. We don't give the option. Because at the Florida Housing Conference, there are people that presented and stated that's exactly what they did. They didn't give them an option. This is what you're gonna do if you wanna get a building development agreement from us.
Yeah, I don't agree with them paying a fee just to say, well, hey, I told you I was going to, but I'm not going to. But I think if we can't make it restrictive like that, which I think that you say, well, we're not going to approve your second phase because you didn't build the units, and hold them accountable to it, so we can push more on affordable housing. But if we can't do that, then I think we need to do a step increase of saying, hey, well, your fees are going to increase over time. So then when they do get towards the set third, fourth phase, and they're like, we got to pay this fee before they start building too, and say, well, I got to pay this fee of $10,000 to move on to second phase because I did not build affordable housing in the first one. So then they get to the second phase. Well, now I got to build, pay $20,000 more to build, start the next phase. If we can't stop them by doing percentages of forcing it, but if we can add more fees to put a hardship on the builders.
Yeah, back then, what happened is that that's only applicable to only DI development that we can negotiate and require them to do that.
Okay.
But now, if they come in straight zoning, our hands are tied, basically. And back then, in DIs, we basically look at this is traced back like 30 years ago, that part of the idea is that you're going to have affordable housing spread throughout the community, mm-hmm. not just like this is, you know, the lower housing community. Mm-hmm. They don't want that. You know,
yes.
We spread throughout only like 2,000 units or so. I think what turned out to be is that it's the complexity of it is that in order to do that, there's a restriction to the ownership of that house.
Mm-hmm.
You have to restrict that particular unit on that street for like 30 years or so,
yeah.
For example. You can't flip that. You know, so and it's just more than just the idea is great, but the implementation of it is very difficult. So basically, at the end of the day, they come back and to the table and renegotiate and say, okay, we'll pay, you know, the local government a certain dollar amount. You can use that to start your housing program or affordable housing program, and that's what not just only one community, but throughout Florida, they did that. So.
No, yeah, I understand that. I completely support having it intermingled so people don't know and then they don't get to that last one. I'm just saying, like, as they start building, hold them accountable. If they don't meet what they told you they were going to, let's implement something that holds them accountable to a monetary or a you can't keep building because you didn't meet the requirements, and then we revisit their building plan for the next phase.
And you know, most developers are going to be looking at minimum units, a minimum number of units to get a profit that they're looking for. So when we reduce our minimum lot sizes also, that is something we need to look at very carefully. Because when we reduce the minimum lot sizes, we may be losing opportunity to get affordable housing and when they want the density bonuses. So if we look at, if it goes from a 10,000 square foot lot, they're asking for us to reduce it to 5,000 square foot lots, then a part of that negotiations in that development agreement is if you're reducing it to 5,000 square foot lots, then you have to produce X amount of affordable units within it. And then how you protect those units from being flipped, in essence, is those units can then be deposited into a community land trust. And that community land trust will protect the affordability of that particular unit in perpetuity. So the entire development doesn't have to be a community land trust, but those units that are sold at an affordable rate can go into. So I think that's something that we really need to look at too. You know, I know with AHAC and our strategies, the community land trust is something that's a part of that. And so as we go through looking at the housing element, the housing chapter, we may want to look at that. Because there are ways to get it done. There are lots of communities now that are looking at innovative ways of preserving, not only creating, but protecting, preserving affordable housing. Because that's the key now, is protecting it. I think
I'm going to change the subject entirely.
Okay.
We done with that one?
Yeah.
So one thing that is not in here, it wasn't in our comprehensive plan, but I think it's something we probably need to think about, and I don't have a solution for it, but drones and robots and unmanned vehicles are going to be the wave of the future in the next 5 to 10 years. Is there something we should start thinking about in terms of implementing in this transportation section that addresses how those are managed, how they are used, where what they what their do's and don'ts are? It's a big big subject, I know.
Is that the micromobility part with it?
No, micromobility is basically looking at like mopeds or you know e-bikes and different forms like that. Basically, we did look at basically air mobility. I forgot the terminology. Basically, the upcoming trend is this: FAA basically told us that in 2028 they will allow basically vertiports for small. We refer them to as the Jetson.
Yeah.
So it's basically just like drone, and so we are looking into that to see how we're gonna manage that as part of our LDC. Which area would be the suitable location? Because right now, I actually last year there's a company that would want to move its headquarters here, but one of the requirements is that they need to have a vertiport or a heliport. So because the CEO wants to, you know, basically hop on that, go to the airport, you know, get on an airplane. So we didn't have a clue of how we're going to, you know, basically have standards for this at all. But right now, DOT did provide us some preliminary standards for it. So that's the first phase that we think we see that is coming online in the future. By 2028, FAA will allow that. So the question is to us is that, okay, how are we going to restrict that, basically flying over residential community, at what certain height you have to maintain, and all of that, we'll provide that as we study that.
Acoustics, lighting, yeah. All those sort of, yeah.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. And that really covers the transfer of people and goods.
Yeah, Amazon's going to be delivering their boxes. Yes.
The vertical heliports, for lack of a better term right now.
Vertiport is called.
Vertiport. Yeah, it's essentially a helicopter taxi, but then you're going to see also some of the retailers moving to delivering by drones.
And robots.
And robots.
Or unmanned vehicles.
So more jobs will be lost. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Before we wrap up, I would just like to maybe just inform the board that the comments we take, if for those of you who are around for the comprehensive plan update, when we would get comments about particular policies, we were going to create a matrix where we identify the comment from the board, and at the end of it, there's another column where we show you how we address this comment or not address it. But we're going to do something similar for the workshops that we're having, and that matrix will include not just your comments, but comments from the public and comments from City Council per chapter, so that everyone can see out in the open what comments did we hear and how did staff address those comments.
Also, during the comprehensive plan public outreach, we have social pinpoint. We still have that for the LDC. So the public can get on our pinpoint, social pinpoint, in order to provide their comments as it relates to each chapter. Yeah, just
thank you for announcing that, because I know one of the members of the public wanted to speak again, but that's an act, that's a tool that you can use to share your additional comments about tonight's chapter, social pinpoint. Again, thank you all. Do we have any additional questions or comments?
Make
Same
a motion.
None. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
I'll make the motion.
Second?
Second.
We are adjourned. Thank you all.
In favor. Aye.
Aye.